Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon. Thank you for attending. As John mentioned in his intro, I'm one of these guys who likes to go overseas and meet interesting folks and ask them all sorts of interesting questions. What I want to present to you today is a slice of a larger research project that was funded by the National Institute of Justice. That research project, which is available online, the final report, as the NIJ publishes it in their various websites, is out there. This concerns one aspect of that research. What happened was I was in Spain kicking around and doing interviews in Madrid. In this research, I was interested in organizational learning as experienced by Islamist militants. And in Spain, I experienced some difficulty accessing the informants of interest. Then I kept hearing about this place, Ceuta. And I decided, well, gee, Ceuta, what's going on in Ceuta? First of all, what is Ceuta? The top of the slide, that is the Iberian Peninsula. The body of water, or the bottom piece, is Morocco. The body of water in between is the Strait of Gibraltar. Okay. Ceuta is right here. It's a legacy of colonialism. In 1956, Spain gave much territory back to Morocco, but they held on to a couple of cities, Ceuta and Melilla, as well as some other places. This is a contested territory in terms of Spanish and Moroccan relations. Morocco wants Ceuta back, and Spain, as well as Melilla and some of the other territories, and Spain wants to keep it. More interestingly, for this research, Ceuta and Melilla and some of these other territories have been identified by the jihadists as enemy territory that needs to be captured for the greater glory of reestablishing the caliphate. So I decided it might be interesting to go down there and try and do some field work. As I mentioned, this was part of a broader study. There's a link to it there. And this study is interested, as John mentioned, in how militants learn, how they gather information about their activities, what they do with that information once they have it, and whether or not at the end of the day they are capable of applying that knowledge and experience to improve their operations. Okay, these are cultural data, okay, that we're talking about here. We're trying to understand how organizations function, trying to understand how people within groups and organizations share information. And when you're dealing with these sorts of cultural data, certain sampling methods are entirely appropriate. In this case, non-probability sampling. But it's important to keep in mind that when you engage in non-probability sampling, that has implications for the findings of your research. One of the things that I've tried to do in this study is lay my methodological cards out straight, because in the field of qualitative research on terrorism, this isn't always done, and it's led to, I think, some problems with inferences that are made on the data. So I try to lay this out. These were some of the field methods that I used. That was the basic research design. Be happy to talk about more of the specifics of that in the Q&A. Why case studies? You know, as John mentioned, you know, a lot of this goes back to the sorts of research questions that you're asking. Different methods are appropriate to different sorts of research questions. The research questions that I was interested in understanding, not necessarily the outcome of learning, that's part of it, but really I'm a process guy. I want to unpack these organizations and understand the informational processes that take place within them. Case studies are well suited for that sort of approach. With case studies, you can explore different propositions, you can try and explain different processes such as organizational learning. You can also try to dig deeper than, say, newspaper accounts, which are a primary source of data for many studies on terrorism. You can also seek to challenge existing interpretations, and that relates to the story that I'm about to tell you about Ceuta. Again, it's important to keep in mind that different cases may not be representative of the larger universe of cases, and depending on the probability on the sampling methods you use, in this case non-probability, you have to be very careful when you try to generalize, when you try to make inferences based on your data, because some findings may not be generalizable. Okay? That doesn't mean we can't learn from case studies. Some cases are intrinsically important. A case study of Al-Qaeda is an important phenomenon, or a case study of Colombian drug traffickers, which is how I got started. I mean, some cases are so important that even if they do represent extremes, policymakers and practitioners can benefit from better understanding these phenomena. And also, I would agree with qualitative methodologists who argue that you can build theory through cross-case comparison. So here we're looking at one case that I would argue is not well understood in the West. It's not, definitely not well understood in counterterrorism circles. And I'm talking about Príncipe Alfonso, Prince Alphonse. Príncipe Alfonso is in the circle red. It is a neighborhood outside of the center of Ceuta, a couple of kilometers away. Okay. This is an aerial shot of Príncipe Alfonso. All the photos that I show you are my photos, unless you see a note. I don't know if you can see Source Guardia Civil in the lower right-hand corner. So that's not my photo. That's a helicopter photo. Most of the photos I'll show you are mine. So I will highlight when they're not mine. This is just an aerial photo of Príncipe Alfonso. As you can see, very concentrated. About 12,000 to 15,000 people live there. Most, if not all, of the residents are Muslims. And it's portrayed as the perfect incubator of radicalization. It's portrayed as the source of grassroots jihadi networks. Observers have pointed to the barrio's poverty, lack of strong government presence in the neighborhood. People talk about how there's no public services. They point to the presence of what they would call the radical influence of Islam. So they would say there's no beauty parlors there, which is important from that perspective, because women, you know, under a strict interpretation of Islam, you're not supposed to wear makeup, get your hair done, things like that. In general, Príncipe Alfonso is often referred to as the most dangerous neighborhood in Spain. And yet, many of the people making these claims have not actually been there. Okay? This includes scholars that have studied Príncipe Alfonso and have published on Príncipe Alfonso, including leading scholars in Spain, such as this gentleman here, the lead author. Okay, and this is a report that his think tank came out with in November of 2006, which was a case study of the neighborhood. They didn't do any field research there. Okay, I know. I interviewed him. Okay. These are direct quotes from his report. "This district," meaning Príncipe Alfonso, "is one of the most favorable for the jihadist recruitment in Spain." Another direct quote. "Príncipe is with no doubt a ghetto. There is an abundance of graffiti in Príncipe, which transmits the message that everything is allowed." They cite the broken windows, criminological theory. "Only one or two pairs of police officers patrol the district." They say there's very little police presence because basically the police always get chased out. "Not even urban buses." They say there's no city buses that go into Príncipe Alfonso, nor can they come safely to it. Then they talk about the influence of radical Islam. "The existence of greater informal control has been detected, especially one of Salafist orientation," which they inherently interpret Salafism with radical Islam. They also suggest that moral squads may abound in the neighborhood. In conclusion, they say, "The Príncipe Alfonso district is on its way to becoming an area controlled partially or totally by the radicals." Shortly after that report came out, the police conducted an intensive counterterrorism operation in Príncipe Alfonso and some of the other barrios in Ceuta. These are some news photos from that operation. It was Operation Dune. Okay. And this operation, involving about 300 counterterrorism officials, police disrupted what was considered an alleged jihadist group. That occurred in December, a month after that report came out. The origins of this conspiracy were traced to a radical imam in the Darqawiya Mosque, one of the mosques in Príncipe. I'll show you a picture of that. It's considered a classic case of grassroots jihadism or homegrown terrorism. All the members except one were born in Ceuta. Most of them lived in Príncipe. Two of those arrested were brothers of Ahmed Abderrahman. He was the one Spanish citizen who was imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. One of the reasons why I went to Ceuta was to try and interview him. One of the interesting aspects of this case is it speaks to the challenge of counterterrorism law enforcement. What the police found, what they captured in the operation, an air gun, a machete, some documents related to jihadist interpretation of Islam, four laptop computers, a bunch of cell phones. They didn't find any guns. They found no explosives. They found no chemical precursors for making explosives. They found no detailed surveillance of possible targets. Essentially, it was a group of young men, angry young men, talking. After Operation Dune, okay, a couple of months later, this article came out in the Terrorism Monitor. Now, how many folks in this room are familiar with the Terrorism Monitor, just out of curiosity? Okay, it's actually fairly influential in counterterrorism circles. It's produced by the Jamestown Monitor, fairly influential publication. Okay, you can see from the title, this was the cover article, "The Threat of Grassroots Jihadi Networks, a Case Study from Ceuta." Really what they're interested in is Príncipe Alfonso. Like the previous report, no field work. Okay, for their data, they're completely relying on news reports. Okay, which again piqued my curiosity. I was like, is everything that I'm hearing about this neighborhood, is it true? Why is nobody going down there and doing field work on the ground asking these sorts of questions? So like John said, you know, qualitative research, you go in there with one set of questions, stuff happens on the ground, like, hey, let me check it out. You know, this is too important to ignore. So I went in there. Okay, spent in total about 3 weeks to a month in the community. Okay, went in there just about every day, intensive field site visits. Day after day, I went in, walked around, met with community members, met with imams, mosque administrators, Islamic activists, met with members of Tabligh Jamaat. Okay, met with local community members, met with police officers who worked Príncipe Alfonso, one of the guys tell me, we're here, we're working. Met with journalists. Again, those were some of the methods. So what did I find? I want you to keep in mind the earlier characterization that I gave you. Ghetto, lots of graffiti, poverty, okay? These are my pictures, okay, of Príncipe Alfonso. Here's some graffiti I saw. Saw this a couple of times. Basically, it means traitor, snitches. Was never able to figure out exactly what it referred to. There were a couple of different theories when I asked informants. I saw one anti-Semitic scribble. I saw no anti-US graffiti. I saw some anti-Moroccan graffiti in the city proper, south, the center of Ceuta. This is one of the mosques in Príncipe Alfonso, the Prince Mosque. You can see how clean and well-kept these areas are. This is the mosque that was implicated, the radical imam that supposedly helped create the jihadist group from Operation Duna. Again, this is just me walking around the community. That's a taxi cab driver right there, the gentleman there. If you can see him, he was taking me around that day. This was my first day in there. Got off the boat, got a taxi cab driver, went right over. This is just one of the main streets. Some satellite dishes. There's about 10 satellite dishes on top of that apartment building. I don't know, it takes money to buy a satellite dish, okay, whether you're living here or there. You know, I didn't want to take a lot of photos of people because I'd had some bad experiences in Madrid with some prominent terrorism researchers. I wanted to respect people's space and privacy. So you're not going to see a lot of photos of people. But what this one does show you is just typical Western dress. I mean, most people walking around in Western dress, including many women. Women walking around in jeans, many women wearing robes, but colorful robes. I saw virtually no burqas in Principe Alfonso. I saw a lot more burqas in London than I did in this neighborhood. The earlier characterization about no social services. This is the Centro Integral, okay, in Principe Alfonso. Okay. Did some interviews in there. They provide job training for local residents. Okay. Another social services provider in the neighborhood. No buses. Here's a bus. I saw plenty of buses. I also saw military and police presence, but that's a video, and I can't show you a video. I captured them on a video. Just surreptitiously, it was completely accidental. I wasn't looking for them. They just happened to be driving by when I was. This is a beauty shop. Okay, went and hit there, interviewed the woman who works there. She was telling me about her business. Very interesting. So this idea that there's no beauty parlors, there are beauty parlors there. There was also a bunch of barber shops. Again, so here are some quotes from actual interviews with community members, okay? These are direct quotes, okay? I live here and I don't agree that all young men are involved in the radical wing of Islam. We're Muslims, not radicals. This sort of characterization does a lot of harm. The newspapers sell sensationalism. This is hurting the good name of many people. There are 12,000 people here. We're talking about a few that were involved, like in Duna. The reason for this is because we're Muslims. There are social problems. Many people talked about the lack of employment, lack of physical infrastructure. People get alarmed when they read in the press or watch television reports, but when they visit and see for themselves, they are not alarmed. There are some religious associations. I mentioned the Tabligh Jamaat, okay? But this has nothing to do with terrorism. So, you know, what do we... We learned, what did I take away from my field work there? Well, this is a ghetto. You know, I've been to favelas in Rio. I kicked around Colombia, some interesting places. If that's a ghetto, that's the cleanest, most well-maintained ghetto I've ever seen. There were really few external signs of radicalization, and I think you got that sense from some of the photos that I show you. Women in all sorts of dress. Again, no burqas, but there were beauty parlors. Local residents insist they have the neighborhood has a bad reputation. People don't deny the problems. They say there are problems, but they say the neighborhood's not as bad as often depicted. There is no single Muslim community there. It's communities, diversity. You got your Malikis, you got your Salafis, members of Tabligh Jamaat, all sorts of folks. Some are Orthodox, many are not. What you do see is the community of Principe Alfonso is marginalized, and there is little trust in the Spanish government. And yes, there are angry young people in Principe Alfonso, as you might find in Madrid, Barcelona. In fact, Manuel Navarrete made this point in an interview, not with me, but with Frontline. He's talking about Ceuta here in this interview. This is a leading counterterrorism official in Spain. Okay, so this wasn't my interview. Okay, it's not me asking him. This is a totally different person. And he's basically saying the same thing. You can read it for yourself. This is an interesting picture of an old guard outpost on the top of a hill. You can see it underscores a theme I want to illustrate. You can see what it says, Viva Osama, okay? And then underneath, most of which is scratched out, is the word cabrón, okay? Which is a dirty word in Spanish. So what does this mean? What does this mean? Is that support for Osama bin Laden or not? This is one of the challenges of this sort of field work. I'll get that back to in a minute. But another lesson from the field, you know, methodology, research methodology. And so when you read something in the Terrorism Monitor, you should be asking yourself, what's the method behind that? You know, if this guy is doing a qualitative case study and he hasn't done any field work, I don't know. In my book, that raises a red flag. The value of ethnography, being able to dig deeper than the news reports. And ultimately, you want to be able to inform counterterrorism policy, okay? In this case, you know, we need to stem the marginalization in the community, and there's a number of policy interventions that follow from that. And then the picture on this slide, you know, there's a famous story I don't have time to get into, turtles all the way down. It's a famous quote from the anthropologist Clifford Geertz. It, basically, his point was, the deeper you dig, the more uncertain you become. You know, how do we know what that photo means? It could mean, long live Osama, you're the best, go Osama. Or it could mean, Osama, you're an asshole, get out of here. The inherent uncertainty of the ethnographic enterprise. We got to get it right, though. You know, we got to get it right for their sake. That's my young daughter, who was with me while I conducted field work, and as well as my wife was. And that is the young boy of a key informant who was helping me in the community. And they had a great time playing together. And these are some of the things that I've drawn on preparing this presentation. Okay, I'm out of time. Thank you.